My name is Deb Quintel. I'm the Director of Curriculum Development with CALI. I'm speaking today with Professor Robert Lind of Southwestern Law School. Welcome, Professor Lind.
Hello there.
Well, let's talk about copyright law. You teach copyright and trademark law, I believe.
Copyright, trademark, entertainment law, and art and museum law.
Oh, interesting. I know that there's an issue about the word song. We all download songs from iTunes. Is song a word in the Copyright Act?
It is not in the Copyright Act, and in my copyright law class, it is something that is not to be uttered.
Well, why is that? We all know what a song is.
Well, that's the problem. No one really knows exactly what it means, because if you talk to a music publisher, the music publisher is going to talk about the number of songs in its catalog. If you talk to a record company executive, the record company executive is going to talk about how many songs are on the latest CD, and they're not talking about the same thing. One of the most interesting aspects of copyright for me and initial challenge to copyright students in general is the fact that there can be multiple works protected by copyright in a single product, and it's interesting to try to determine what works are involved in a particular situation. The example I use in class is a marching band sampler album that I received a while ago. It was addressed to the band director at Southwestern Law School, and I was the closest thing to it. The sampler album was a marketing device for a company that provides sheet music for marching bands. And so it had about 20 different cuts on the album, and one selection was Raspberry Beret. Now, Raspberry Beret is a work, a musical composition that was composed by Prince and recorded by Prince and his band on one of his albums. Well, that work, the musical composition, is on this track, but because Prince did not create Raspberry Beret with a marching band in mind, he did not include music for tuba, he did not include music for a flute, the sampler album has an arrangement of the musical composition Raspberry Beret by a gentleman by the name of Paul Jennings. And to help the band director decide whether to purchase sheet music for Raspberry Beret for their 76-piece marching band, there's a sound recording of a marching band performing the Paul Jennings arrangement of Prince's Raspberry Beret musical composition. So you have three different works here. You have the musical composition composed by Prince, you have the derivative work, the arrangement that was composed by Paul Jennings, and you have the sound recording that was made of the performance of the marching band. All three are fixed in this sound recording, and all three have different authors and are owned by different copyright owners. And so what I try to do in the copyright class, from the first class on, is to get the students to distinguish between the underlying musical composition and the sound recording. Each has its own subject matter category in Section 102 of the Copyright Act. Each has the separate authorship, and generally the copyright ownership will be different. The music publisher usually owns the copyright in the musical composition. The record company traditionally owns the copyright in the sound recording, and it's known as a master. The sound recording is known as a master. So when you have, for instance, a radio station that plays a track from an album, it is publicly performing two different works. It's publicly performing the musical composition, and it's publicly performing the sound recording. Now, under the Copyright Act, the radio station only has to pay a license for use of the musical composition. There is no public performance right for sound recording. So, to get back to your original question as to what's the meaning of song, doesn't everyone know what that means? If someone says, I heard the song on the radio. That's a statement with an indefinite meaning. Does song mean the musical composition, or does it mean the sound recording? If the radio broadcasts Live and Let Die, as recorded by Wings, and immediately after it plays Live and Let Die, recorded by Guns N' Roses, has the radio played two songs, or has it played two versions of one song? One of the CDs that I bring into class is a Rhino Records Louie Louie compilation. It's a compilation of 16 recordings, all of the same composition, which is Louie Louie, that was composed by Richard Berry. So when I have that CD in my hand, is there one song on the CD? Is there 16 songs? Are there 17 songs on the CD? No one really knows what it means. A music publisher will say, I just bought a 400-song catalog. Well, I know what that person means by the term song just from the context of the conversation. The music publisher is concerned with musical compositions, not sound recordings. So I spent some time in class trying to get students to take song out of their lexicon for the semester, and ask them to use the specific terminology of the Copyright Act, that being musical compositions or musical works and sound recordings. And what I hear from former students after they've graduated from law school and they're working in the music business, what I hear is that my nitpicking approach comes to mind whenever they're dealing with an agreement or negotiating terms. And whenever someone on the other side uses the term song, my students tend to be fairly quick to say, well, you've got to define that term. Now, what are you talking about? But that's one of the initial points with the copyright class, is to show students that there are terms of art and there are also terms that are used in the business, but you have to be able to understand what is meant by the use of particular terms.
Well, what about performance? What about a public performance if I am up on stage singing a song? Is my performance going to be protected by copyright?
It won't be, at least not in my view, because only works are protected by copyright, not performances of those works. So if you were performing a musical work that was in the public domain, such as Star Spangled Banner, there's no copyright involved in that situation. The musical composition is not protected by copyright. Your performance is not protected by copyright. If your performance had been recorded on videotape, well, then a protectable work has been created, but that work is an audiovisual work, and the author of the audiovisual work owns the copyright in that work, not you, the performer.
So if someone is sitting in the audience and they record either with an audio player or a video camera my singing of the song, they're going to own the copyright even though I've been performing?
Now, if you were in my class, I'd ask you, what did you mean by song?
Oh, right. Right. I'm sorry, Professor Lynn. I just violated the rule here. I used the word song. Let's remove this from me. Let's suppose that there's a comedian or an improv troupe doing some sort of original comedic show, and people are in the audience watching, and see, I'm avoiding that whole song original derivative composition question here. So we've got an improv troupe, for example, performing based off of audience suggestions. So they're doing an original scene that's never before been done on stage. If I understand correctly, that scene is not going to be protected as copyright as it stands.
It would be, because the difference between your initial hypothetical of you performing music and the improv group is that when the hypothetical with you performing music was that you were performing something you did not write and it was in the public domain. With the improv group, the entire group is writing, in essence, a literary work while they are performing it. So it is a live performance of something that's being created on the spot. So it's as though you were writing the great American novel while speaking into a sound recording.
So it's being protected because it's being recorded?
It's protected because it's being fixed in the recording. But what is being fixed in the recording is copyrightable subject matter. It is the literary work.
If the improv troupe has got an audio recorder in the corner of the stage recording it, they're fixing the work. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what if someone is sitting in the audience and despite the no use of recorders or filming is permitted disclaimer, they're recording away. Do they have a copyright also?
That is uncertain. Their fixation is not going to aid you in getting a federal copyright unless you have authorized their recording. And it's been untested, to my knowledge, as to whether an after-the-fact authorization would be a sufficient, but chances are, yes, it would. With the bootlegger that's sitting in the audience, and it's a non-musical performance for copyright purposes, the question is whether or not there's sufficient originality in the creating of the sound recording. And I would say yes, that there would be sufficient creativity. That person may have a copyright in the sound recording, but that person would also be likely to be looking at a state criminal law charge for bootlegging. And if it were music, if we would go back to the original hypothetical, and the bootlegger has now fixed a musical performance, then the performer can bring an action under Section 1101 of Title 17 of the U.S. Code. I say that rather than Section 1101 of the Copyright Act because it's not part of the Copyright Act. And this is the federal bootlegging statute, which says anyone who makes an unauthorized fixation of a musical performance or distributes an unauthorized fixation of a musical performance is liable for damages and injunction, and in fact, there are criminal penalties involved as well. And the reason why Congress enacted that statute was because Congress believed that performers needed to be protected from bootlegging and that copyright did not protect performances. So if you were performing a musical work that you yourself authored and someone bootlegged your performance, not only could you sue as a performer under Section 1101, but you could also sue for copyright infringement. But that's because what was being reproduced by the bootlegger was a musical composition that is copyrightable subject matter. So it's not the performance that's the copyright infringement, but rather the reproduction of your work. And so this performance issue comes in a number of different situations. For instance, with motion picture actors, they are hired to provide personal services to a motion picture studio. Their service is to deliver lines, which are generally written by a screenwriter, and hitting their marks as designated by the film's director. There's no authorship in such services. If you're simply reading from the Manhattan phone book, that's not copyrightable. The phone book may be, particularly if it's the yellow pages rather than the white pages, but your reading from them is not going to be protected. Now, if an actor adds protectable elements to a character or suggests changes in the storyline or improvises dialogue, and assuming that those changes are sufficient to be protected by copyright because they're sufficiently original, then authorship may be involved, but that's not a mere performance. You've now gone beyond the performance to something creating a work or creating changes in the work. One example is the memorable scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark, where there's a showdown in a marketplace between Indiana Jones and a very large gentleman with a huge sword. The script called for an extended fight scene in the market between these two characters. The swordsman, in fact, had spent days practicing his movements, the choreography of the fight. However, the day that it was being filmed, Harrison Ford was not feeling well, was very ill, and wanted to basically get off the set as soon as possible. So when the fight scene began and the two square off in the marketplace, Harrison Ford unexpectedly just shrugged, pulled his pistol out, and shot the swordsman. That ended the fight scene, and Harrison Ford was able to walk off the set. So is that change in the script sufficiently original for copyright protection? Well, perhaps, but it was not merely a performance of the script. And so because there can be those kinds of additions added by actors, motion picture studios have actors sign a personal service contract that includes a work-made-for-hire provision so that the studio owns any copyrightable works or changes that the actor has created within the course of making the film. With other situations, the subject of a photograph is not the author of the photograph. It's the photographer. It's the person who selects the camera and sets it up and decides what film to use and what aperture, how much light to allow into the camera, and when to push the plunger so that you get the photograph taken at the right time. The recording, sound recording of birds chirping or dolphins communicating does not give authorship to the birds or the dolphins. It's the person who is actually doing the recording. Because when you're looking at the work for which protection is sought, the question is, what are the creative elements that go into the creation of that work and who's responsible for those creative elements? So one of the debates that we have in my copyright class is dealing with the recording artist. If you have a recording artist who is not also a composer, it's not a singer-songwriter, it is someone who is recording someone else's material. So you have a recording artist who merely performs a musical composition written by another composer in a recording studio. That recording artist, I would suggest, but not everyone agrees with me on this, is not an author. If the recording artist makes no changes in the musical work, doesn't change a note, doesn't change a word, the composer is the author of the musical composition, not the performing artist. The other work that's at issue in that kind of situation is the sound recording. And the work being created in that recording studio is the sound recording. So the question is, what are the creative elements of the sound recording and who's responsible for them? Well, what makes a sound recording is certainly not the content of what is being recorded. Whether it's a band or birds or waves crashing on the beach, that's not relevant to what constitutes a sound recording. What constitutes a sound recording is the selection of the recording device, placement of microphones, the soundboard settings, mixing the sound. Those are what constitute the sound recording. In fact, you may have a situation where you have the same recording artist performing the same musical composition on several recordings, and each of the recordings can sound very different. And each of those recordings can have a separate copyright protecting each of them. The recording artist really is just providing the content, the same as waves crashing on the beach. Another thing to keep in mind that students tend to just understand as an afterthought, if you have the scenario where you have a vocalist, a recording artist who is known as a singer rather than the band, and the singer comes in, picks up the music, and sings into the microphone and sings the words and the music that she sees on the sheet of paper, if that person is doing something that should be deemed authorship, then so are the studio musicians that are playing behind her, so are the backup singers who are performing with her, and it can't be just the featured recording artist. So I think similar to the situation with the term song, where students need to understand and think through what exactly you're talking about, same thing holds true for performance versus the work that's being performed. If they can isolate the two and do the analysis on that basis, then I think they get a firmer grasp of what copyright is intended to protect.
Professor Lin, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You are listening to Cali Radio. This has been a presentation from the Center for Computer-Assisted Legal Instruction. Please visit our website at www.cali.org to download additional podcasts from Cali Radio.